coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. Newcastle County plans to spend its American Rescue Plan funding with an eye toward increasing equity.
A virus attacks the human body all in the same way, but COVID, this pandemic, has not attacked every community in our county, in our state, in our country the same way. And the reason is existing inequities.
We talked to Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer about how he sees these funds addressing inequities. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine how Delaware is trying to end the disproportionate impact of one form of breast cancer and learn more about what's behind rising visits to the Nemours Children's Hospital ER. Plus, the latest edition of Arts Playlist heads outdoors. It's all next on The Green, where Delaware gets tuned into a first state of mind. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Newcastle County officials announced Tuesday a plan to put the county's over $108 million in American Rescue Plan Act funds toward increasing equity. Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt talks with Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer about the details of this agenda.
This week, you described the federal COVID relief funds as a new deal for our generation and a commitment to equity. So first, just why the focus on equity?
So we've done a lot of thinking about what this $108 million, the over $1 billion that the state has gotten and approximately $108 million that Newcastle County is getting. What does that mean? What is it for? There are hundreds of pages of regulations and other law statute about how to spend these resources, but how do we look at it in a way that's meaningful to people of the county? There are a lot of different directions we can go with this. The CARES Act, last year's stimulus, we really saw it as an emergency package to keep our community healthy, both physically, mentally, economically, basically to survive through a very difficult time. We think this stimulus, this American Rescue Plan, is really something different. It's about taking a look at where our community is in light of COVID, and as the president likes to say, build back better. I think there's nowhere that the problems and issues of COVID have been evident as with inequity within our community. As I said at our press event, a virus attacks the human body all in the same way, but COVID, this pandemic, has not attacked every community in our county, in our state, in our country the same way. And the reason is existing inequities, as you will, social preconditions. And so what we can do now as we emerge from this pandemic is work on some of those social preconditions. It's very hard. Simply standing up at a press conference and announcing some allocations of funding, some investments in important programs is not enough to address these social preconditions, but we believe it's an important first step.
So part of this process with the American Rescue Plan funds was, a process of public engagement where you sought input as to how your constituents want the money spent. What did you hear through that process?
One thing we heard is that there needs to be an emphasis on equity, on jobs, and on housing. Almost every recommendation that we received, most comments in public forums, and we held over 30 meetings, five or six different committees. County Council had their own committee meetings. Almost every comment in there could be categorized as needing to address problems of equity, needing to address jobs, and needing to address housing in our community. And that's why we've set up those three pillars of our ARPA investments.
So you announced several million dollars will go towards something called the Building Better Communities Initiative. What will this do?
So what the Building Better Communities Initiative will do is we're setting up a commission on hopeful communities that is establishing recommendations. The goals are to reduce violence and increase community engagement in underserved neighborhoods through Newcastle County. There are many places across our county that are thriving. thriving economically, thriving in terms of parks and open spaces, thriving in terms of job and housing market, and things are working as they should. In fact, I would say that's the case for the majority of the population of New Castle County. But there are certain underserved neighborhoods where violence rates are totally unacceptable for 2021, where the unemployment rate is totally unacceptable for an advanced economy, where health outcomes, where, you know, all sorts of savings and wealth metrics are really not where they should be. And these are hard problems. It's taken really hundreds of years for us as a community to get to where we are today. But we're going to start to try and turn the corner on many of those.
You also announced a focus on environmental justice. What can the county really do in this space?
That's what we're looking at. We haven't fully fleshed out everything. There are clearly, when you just look at land use, literally from a 30,000 foot level at a map across our community, you see a shortage of open spaces and parks in lower served neighborhoods and in lower income neighborhoods. You see a risk of environmental liability, sometimes at a nuisance level and sometimes more serious than that. Some of them, some of those issues and some of those neighborhoods are right on the Route 9 corridor where we made our announcement of the focus on equity. We're gonna be looking at various projects. There are a number of ideas that have been proposed to us, and we're gonna look at each one and see what makes sense for investment of the taxpayer dollar.
So we've covered the massive investment in housing that the county has planned for these funds. You also announced a focus on workforce development. Can you tell me more? What will that look like?
The state had announced a few weeks ago a $50 million investment from its stimulus funds. Our goal with our investment in workforce is not to replicate anything the state is doing. We don't want two governments that are kind of tripping over each other. What we're looking at now is that, in addition to sort of your standard workforce development programs to teach people the trades, the construction industry is booming in many ways, to teach people coding from a young age so that they can get into software development and networking job opportunities, which are really plentiful in today's market. A lot of the challenges in employment today have to do with other things outside of sort of the traditional job training, where people may have problems with their family or with their personal relations. They might have issues with housing. They might have medical or disability issues. They might have difficulty accessing other public resources that are available to them. So we're talking now with one group that may potentially provide sort of wraparound services, so that, just as an idea, we're not 100% sure we're going to move forward with this now, but potentially those enrolled in state programs in New Castle County and state workforce development programs could also enroll in the county program as a supplement to get wraparound services, so that if you're having additional difficulty sticking in a job or in a career, you can get assistance with that.
I'm curious, did you look into whether you could do direct payments? You know, if your goal is really just to tackle inequities within the county and, you know, relieve poverty, why not just give people money?
So it's a good question. We did not look at direct payments because if you do some, or I can say we did, but it's if you look at basic math, you're talking about $108 million. Even if you used every dollar of that on direct payments, you have about 600,000 people. You're looking at less than $200 per person. I just don't think that that's something meaningful to address the kind of problems we see. We think more targeted assistance makes more sense.
Okay. And also, in terms of how you're allowed to use the money, I know you said that this is an effort to get to those underlying inequities that produce the disparate impacts of the virus that we've seen. But things like, you know, environmental justice or strengthening business corridors that were struggling pre-pandemic, you know, are these things really related to the pandemic?
So that is a very complex question. The short answer is no. Of course, every sort of business challenge right now has not been caused by the pandemic. What we're looking at more is what are the preconditions? What was going on in our community that caused the pandemic to be so lethal in certain communities? And what can we do to address those preconditions? What can we do to address the fact that particularly in lower income communities, so few people have a primary care provider? They rely, so many families rely on the emergency room as their primary care. There, it's not as simple as it seems. There's a shortage of primary care physicians in our county, for example. And looking at some of those issues and seeing what we can do on a comprehensive basis to address some of those preconditions that we think made COVID-19 particularly deadly in certain communities of our county.
So the next steps, you know, your administration plans to give a full budget for the American Rescue Plan funding to county council soon. What are the next steps to getting this equity agenda implemented?
So I have believed from day one of my administration, number one, in democracy, that my job as executive is to propose things to the legislative branch. There are thousands, probably tens of thousands of governments across the country getting this federal stimulus. Many of them, the executive is standing up declaring how the money will be spent, and that's how it's being spent. It was important to me with the CARES Act dollars. It's also important to me with these American Rescue Plan dollars that the funding does go to county council for approval. And so we are, the next step is that we bring a budget for this equity agenda and our American Rescue Plan Act investments to county council. I believe right now it's slated to be voted on at their November 9th meeting. And then the hard part starts, implementation. Because as I have always said, this is not about investing, standing up, having a press event, announcing an investment of dollars and walking away. It's about achieving certain outcomes. And I imagine there are some things we're going to do well and some things not so well. And we got to work on emphasizing our dollars and our taxpayer investments in those things that are working.
Thanks to Newcastle County Executive Matt Meyer and our Sophia Schmidt for joining us this week on The Green. Next on The Green, Nemours Children's Hospital in Wilmington is seeing a spike in emergency department visits, but unnecessary trips there may be fueling that rise. We talk with the hospital's chief of emergency medicine about it. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Doctors at Nemours Children's Hospital say wait times are soaring, putting additional pressure on an already stressed emergency department. In August and September, Nemours Children's Hospital logged more than 20,000 ER visits. That's over 250 every day. Many of the patients come in with flu or COVID-like symptoms that don't require going to an emergency room, and Nemours is hoping to let people know there are other options to consider before going to the ER. We sat down this week with Dr. John Loisel, chief of the Emergency Medicine Division at Nemours, to discuss this issue.
You saw over 250 emergency room visits per day in August and September. Can you tell us a little bit about what that looks like in real terms in the ED, in terms of wait times, how you manage staff? What does that look like when you have that kind of volume?
Well, that's a particularly high volume for us. Normally, this time of year, we'd see about 125 to 130 patients a day. So this is greatly increased from that. Now, anytime you come to the emergency department, on entering the emergency department, you usually see a trained triage nurse who makes an assessment of exactly how ill your child is and whether it's safe to wait to be seen or not. Those patients who are critically ill or potentially very ill get seen right away, but those patients that can safely wait will wait when there's such a long or such a high volume as we're seeing currently.
Is there a sense of about what that wait time might look like?
It can vary very dramatically. As I said before, if you are particularly ill, if you have an underlying disorder that is potentially very serious, or you come in with very severe symptoms, you will be seen right away. But if not, that wait can be anywhere from 30 minutes to several hours.
And has that trend continued here into October? Are you seeing kind of a similar or any kind of decline in that volume of patients you're seeing?
I can't say we're seeing the decline quite yet. We are still averaging well over 200 patients a day through October at this point. Most of those are viral illnesses. They're usually some of the common respiratory viruses that we normally see. Some are occurring now during a time when we don't usually see them. So that has combined to make a very high volume for us right now.
We had heard in recent years about long wait times in ERs and in many hospitals nationwide. Were you seeing some of this before the current spike you're seeing in visits? And if so, was there any drivers to that kind of general uptick in ED visits?
Well, we never like to have patients wait in the emergency departments. It's as stressful to us in the emergency department, I think, as it is to the people who are waiting in the waiting room. But I would say a lot of that wait time has been overblown at times in the past. Certainly during times of surges like this, it is real. It is a real long wait, and we understand that patients or parents of young children who are sick are very anxious about that type of wait, so we try to minimize it as much as we can to do that. But we have a certain limitation in terms of staffing and space to see them all as quickly as we'd like to. During the COVID pandemic, we thought that we were going to see a huge surge of COVID patients. In actuality, our volume was very low during that period of time, and our wait times were about 5 to 10 minutes, regardless of the level of illness you came in with. So there are times that we can keep that flow going very quickly and that turnaround very quickly and the wait very short.
So after that drop during the pandemic, this spike probably feels even more severe to you because you're not coming from an average. You're actually coming from a below average up to a above average.
Well, exactly. And so during that period of time, our volume was about 60% of what it normally is at that time. Our staffing was great for that amount of patients. And of course, we try to staff accordingly to the number of patients that we're seeing, and then to quickly make a transition into something that is 2 to 3 times that volume is very difficult, and you just can't suddenly find nurses and physicians who are specialized in emergency medicine to come in and take over that place. So it makes it stressful and a lot of hard work for the staff that are here.
So you know, this current spike, you've noted, seems to be driven by people coming in with COVID-like symptoms, flu or COVID-like symptoms. Is it fair to say maybe perhaps the pandemic and you know, the fact that younger kids aren't vaccinated yet is perhaps the primary reason that parents are a little bit nervous? They see these symptoms. They know their kids aren't vaccinated. They're like, oh my gosh, something's wrong. I got to go to the emergency department.
Sure. I think COVID has made a big impact on that for parents. But I'd emphasize that the vast majority of the patients that we're seeing with respiratory-like illnesses, cough, fever, sore throats, and headaches, are generally not COVID. They're usually other viral illnesses that we typically see. But we do understand that I think a lot of parents are worried that this could be COVID and are worried what that means for their child. So I think a lot of times that's what's bringing them to the emergency department more than the typical symptoms.
But generally speaking, if you have that type of illness, flu, respiratory, and I guess even COVID, an ED is not necessarily the place you want to be, right? Is that, you know, it's probably not the best place for you, at least initially.
Right. Same as with the flu or any upper respiratory infection, COVID in children is generally not as severe. So you can still evaluate your children according to how they're acting at that time. And the first call should always be to the primary care office. Most of the time, this is not an emergency that you need to come into the emergency department for. Many times, there's not a lot that we will do in addition to other testing or other treatment for this type of an illness.
So I guess you kind of started to allude to it a little bit there. But so if you are a parent who's seeing a child who's having these kind of symptoms, whether they be COVID-like, flu-like, you mentioned going to a primary. What else should parents maybe do in the interim to see what's going on with their child before they would even consider coming to an emergency department?
Well, again, if your child has respiratory symptoms, the common ones I just mentioned, cough, fever, sore throat, you could treat that as you would normally treat any upper respiratory type of infection. If you think your child is getting sicker for any reason, then again, your first call is the primary care office. They may be able to see you there. They may be able to give you information or instructions on what to do or watch for in your child. They may recommend something like an urgent care or even a telehealth visit that may mean that you don't have to come to the emergency department, as we won't do a lot more than that.
a lot of parents may think that coming to the ED department would get them a test done and a test result faster than perhaps if they went to a community resource or got it through their school. That isn't the case, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, most of our testing is done for patients who are admitted, who we need to know are in the hospital and are free of COVID. We do some additional testing in the emergency department, but many parents I'm seeing are coming to the emergency department worried about COVID and wanting their child tested for COVID. And it's not the best place to do that. There are community sites that are much quicker, much easier, and you'll get that information in about the same period of time. So we would recommend that that's where they go for that testing. And we also recognize that a number of parents aren't allowed to bring their child back into school until they've been tested for COVID. And we know that's a difficult situation because otherwise they're going to be out for prolonged periods of time. But again, there are other sites to get tested, and we recommend that you look for those first. Either check with your primary care physician, check online. Delaware.gov has a list of places in Delaware in which to get tested, but it's not the most efficient way to get it done here through the emergency department.
Are there some things that parents should be kind of wary of? Like if they're starting to see these symptoms, would there be things for you as someone who deals in emergency department cases that would be maybe red flags that would be, you know, maybe coincide with the kind of typical flu-like symptoms that you'd say, oh, you know what, that sounds a little different. Maybe an ER visit is appropriate.
The common symptoms that we'd be more worried about is a child who is working much harder to breathe. They're either breathing much faster, they're using a lot more muscles to breathe with, their rib cage is starting to collapse in because of the effort, or a child who your concern is getting particularly dehydrated. We know they're not going to drink as well as they normally do when they're ill at any time, but if they are significantly below their normal intake and maybe showing signs of becoming more lethargic, then those patients absolutely need to be seen. The other symptom that we're seeing a lot of is a patient who is wheezing. Many times in young infants, the virus itself will cause some degree of wheezing. Many children will get through that without a problem. But if they're working particularly hard to breathe with that wheezing, that may require an emergency department visit.
You talked a little bit before about how this, you know, kind of impacts the rest of the work that's being done in the ED. You know, how much of a ripple effect is there when you start seeing a volume of these patients who really don't necessarily need to be there? How does that, you know, impact, you know, what you're trying to do and what your staff is trying to accomplish on a day-to-day basis?
It obviously makes it more difficult to be able to see those patients in a very timely fashion. We never tell a parent, never come to the emergency department. If they think their child is sick enough to come to the emergency department, they should do that. But I think by checking in with the primary care office first, we may save them time and effort, and it also saves time and effort for us here. We can concentrate on patients who really need the type of services and resources that we have here in the emergency department.
And I would imagine also we've heard a lot about, and you've talked a little bit about the kind of just general stress that you guys are under in terms of staffing and the hours that nurses and doctors are working. How important is it to kind of keep that volume down where possible to make sure that the staff is as fresh and ready to do their job as possible?
Well, of course, we would love always to, you know, to have a little bit more time to spend with the sickest patients that we can when we're in the emergency department. And so any additional time that we have, we will take that to care for the sickest patients that we can. That being said, we certainly will try to spend as much time as we need to with any patient that comes to the emergency department.
Any other thoughts you want to share with parents who are, you know, just, you know, again, generally concerned, you know, should I, shouldn't I go to an emergency department?
Yeah, well, I would also say that, you know, besides your primary care office, which should be your first source of any information or recommendations, there's some online resources that are going to be helpful too. And certainly the CDC website, cdc.gov, is useful. We have a kidshealth.org website here that is exceptionally good in terms of giving you parents as well as patients information about illnesses and has a long section on COVID. But again, there are other sources for you to go to in terms of looking for answers or questions you may have about your child's illness.
Thanks to Nemours Chief of Emergency Medicine, Dr. John Loisel, for his time this week. And stay with us. We take a look at continuing efforts to address disparities in the impact cancer has in the First State, specifically with an aggressive form of breast cancer. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Delaware leads the nation in an aggressive form of breast cancer that has a disproportionate impact on black women, especially younger women. Earlier this month, a researcher with Christiana Care updated the Delaware Cancer Consortium on potential steps to improve early detection and reduce such disparities. And as Christiana Care's Director of Population Health Research, Scott Siegel, told Delaware Public Media's Rebecca Baer, someday it could be as simple as a blood test.
What do we know about the racial disparities involving breast cancer in Delaware, and how significant are they?
Sure. So in Delaware, like we see nationally, there is a higher mortality rate observed for Black women compared to white women across the board, even though the incidence rates, so the rates of new cases are either pretty similar between Black and white women or even a little bit lower among Black women, but we see higher rates of mortality for Black women. And that's nationally in the order of 40% or so higher. Locally, we see a similar across the board disparity, although when you look at younger women specifically, so if you're thinking like 40 to 64 age group, then that disparity is larger, more in the order of 56%.
Delaware, though, has had some success in addressing disparities involving certain other types of cancer. Can you tell us about that and how it relates to what you hope to do with breast cancer?
In terms of disparities, the greatest success story we can point to is in colorectal cancer, where there was a disparity in both screening, so colonoscopies or other screening tests, and also a disparity in mortality, where Black people were dying at higher rates. So this was, there was a very robust program that was put in place statewide that predates me, but they were successful at first in closing the disparity in screening so that Black and white people were getting the same access and the same rates of screening. And then eventually that translated into the elimination of the disparity. And then that continues through today. So that was, you know, quite an accomplishment, something that has multiple times received national attention, both in the cancer world and just from the general media. And for a lot of reasons, they focused on colorectal cancer as their first disease site because there are some very clear things you can do. We have a screening test that's also can cure you, right? So if you have a suspicious polyp, for instance, when they're screening, they can remove it. And then that, in most cases, cures you of anything that might have developed. When you get to other cancers, like breast cancer, it's more complicated. There isn't as straightforward of an approach. There isn't a single intervention that will close this by itself. So what we want to do is basically recreate the success that we had with colorectal cancer, but do it now in other cancers, like breast cancer. We know it's more complicated, but we are much more sophisticated in our understanding of things. We have, you know, lessons we can draw on from the past. So going forward, you know, we think we're prepared to take on more complex issues and just keep repeating that same success story over and over is our hope.
Now, do we know what some of the reasons behind those racial disparities are as they relate to breast cancer?
Again, nationally, we see that Black women don't have access to the same quality of mammography and other screening, which can lead to delays in diagnosis. And then once there's a diagnosis, nationally, there's data to show that there's delays in getting treatment or that treatment standards are not met. And so all of that can certainly contribute to these disparities we see. There's been a number of studies that have looked at that specific part of this question, and the estimates range in terms of what percentage access to care and prevention explain this, but at least half, if not quite a bit more than half of that disparity can be attributed to other factors outside of just access to screening and care. We see differences in tumor biology. So Black women, for instance, are more likely to be diagnosed with a particularly aggressive subtype of breast cancer called triple negative breast cancer. And that's I was presenting results at that consortium meeting based specifically on triple negative. We know that there are differences in terms of comorbidities. So conditions like type 2 diabetes are more prevalent among Black women. And we also have evidence that those comorbidities predict a greater likelihood of breast cancer and predict poor outcomes among women who do develop breast cancer. And we know that there are neighborhood effects, that, you know, environmental factors. Living in poorer neighborhoods has been consistently associated with poorer breast cancer outcomes. And then exposures. So there are potentially modifiable risk factors, things like alcohol use or diet, physical activity, reproductive factors, which there are several in that category. All of those things contribute. So it's a very complicated, what we would say, multi-level set of factors that drive this. So anything we do to try to meaningfully reduce the disparity is going to have to take multiple efforts.
And in fact, in your research, you discovered that there were certain what you called hot spots right. in Newcastle County. What can you tell us about that and how that data might be used?
Yeah, so we did find that there were two areas in Newcastle County. We only looked within Newcastle County for this set of analyses, but there were two areas where we saw a statistically significant elevated rate of triple negative breast cancer relative to other invasive types of breast cancer. So we know that in Delaware, we have among the highest rates of triple negative breast cancer in the country. And I already shared that, you know, that's concerning because it's an aggressive subtype and it disproportionately affects Black women. And then within Delaware, we know most of these cases are in Newcastle County. But then within Newcastle County, now we know there are these two areas where there's even higher rates. And then there are other areas where there are lower rates. So in terms of what do we use this information, how do we use this information to improve upon things? Well, we can think about this at a few different levels. One is certainly healthcare centers and primary care clinics within these hotspots can be sure to do comprehensive screening to make sure that this is a priority for their patients, to make sure we're doing outreach, make sure women are coming in for their scheduled appointments. We can also start to think about what's happening in those communities that might be contributing. And so we can get into this more, but we did look at some risk factors that are associated with breast cancer. And we can't say if this is true in a causal way, but we saw a correlation between a higher rate of those risk factors in these hotspots. So we can think about what can we do at a community level, and then potentially, in some of our future work, what can we do to actually do even earlier detection, particularly among women in these communities?
And I think one thing that you had pointed out earlier was the use of alcohol and mm-hmm. how it contributes to breast cancer.
Yeah. So this is not common knowledge, but alcohol is a well-established risk factor for breast cancer. And it's not the leading risk factor, but it is a well-established risk factor. And as it turns out, according to a report that came out earlier this year, Delaware is actually number one in the country for what we would call alcohol-attributable breast cancer. And according to that estimate, nearly one in five breast cancer cases in Delaware can be attributed to alcohol use. So given the link between alcohol and breast cancer and our known issue here in Delaware, we did look at rates of unhealthy alcohol use in Newcastle County, as well as features of what we would call the built environment, including numbers of alcohol retailers that sell alcohol for offsite consumption. And in one of the hotspots, we saw clear evidence of high rates of unhealthy alcohol use, as well as very high rates of alcohol retailers.
You mentioned looking at risk prediction and early detection. What are some of those things you think can be done to address these types of disparities?
One possibility is just to use routine screening, mammography and other screening forms, but make sure we're actually starting them at the earliest recommended ages. We're not putting it off. We're being very conscientious about doing that, particularly in communities where the risks are higher. But we also know that mammograms by themselves probably are not sufficient to detect these cancers early enough. Sometimes they're harder to detect, the more aggressive cases, or the cases that prove to be more aggressive. So the research we're currently doing is trying to understand whether we can use biomarkers from blood to predict risk of breast cancer even before it would be detectable through a mammogram. So similar to the way that if you go to your doctor and you get a cholesterol test and your doctor uses the results from your cholesterol test to understand what's your risk of developing heart disease and what things can we put in place today, should we put in place today to help prevent or manage that risk. We don't really have a comparable lab test for breast cancer. That's what we're working towards. We're in the early stages of that biomarker discovery research. But by fully engaging with the entire community, including women who are most at risk, then we're in a better position to actually identify those biomarkers. And I should just be very clear that this is research that involves large teams. I'm just one member of the team. This is very multidisciplinary in nature.
Are there any other additional steps that you plan to take?
Another step that I think that we can take, which is why I was presenting to the consortium, is we would like to look at this statewide. I mentioned we only looked at this in Newcastle County. We were using data from our own cancer center registry. So we would like to partner with the state cancer registry to look at this statewide so we can also potentially identify other areas in the other counties where we should focus. A third thing that we can do, I mentioned this briefly before, but what can we do in these communities? So in the other hotspot, we found that there was an issue around obesity. And we also know obesity is a well-established risk factor for breast cancer and poor outcomes. So there are community interventions that have been shown to work, even in predominantly Black neighborhoods where prior interventions haven't been tested or tried. We now have good research to show that there are things we can do to address obesity at a community level, as well as unhealthy alcohol use at a community level. So I think we can think about what would the organizations, which organizations would want to partner, how could we implement something like that, put into practice these evidence-based approaches so that we're addressing these general modifiable risk factors, which, by the way, not only reduce, if we were successful, would not only reduce the risk of breast cancer, but would reduce the risk of a lot of chronic diseases. So those are several things we can do. Like I said, it would take multiple efforts. These are complicated issues. But the main point I really want to convey is it's more a matter of will than it is lack of knowledge at this point. We have enough tools in our toolbox that if we use them, we can make a meaningful dent. We're still doing research because we want to go further, such as with the biomarker research. We want to do better and we want to add to that toolbox. But we can also start doing things in the very short term that can make a meaningful impact.
Thanks to Christiana Cares, Director of Population Health Research, Scott Siegel, and our Rebecca Mayer for their time this week. And we wrap up Green Next with Arts Playlist, where we learn where you can go to find a unique piece of art outdoors. You're listening to The Green on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Art Meets Nature, a new outdoor sculpture made of nature materials at the Brandywine River Museum of Art. Queen Anne's Lace Pod, modeled after a flower that grows at the Brandywine River Museum of Art, is a temporary site-specific installation by Virginia-based artist Ian Stabler. Stabler says the exhibit is made entirely of natural materials, which he gathered and found on site. And in this week's Arts Playlist, Stabler chats with Delaware Public Media's Kelly Steele about Queen Anne's Lace Pod in the Potts Meadow along the Brandywine's Harvey Run Trail in Chatsford, PA.
We're talking about this whimsical outdoor sculpture that sprung up on the Brandywine Conservancy and Museum of Arts campus grounds for the summer. Give me all the particulars. What's the exhibit about?
It's really about how do we inhabit our environment in a more intentional way. So the actual sculpture itself is made of sticks that are found from the site, all screwed together, and it's huge. I mean, it's 8 feet around and about 16 feet tall. And you can actually go inside and inhabit it. It's got a bench in the inside. So it's really a space that can be inhabited by the person. It is built to look like the Queen Anne's Lace pod. So the Queen Anne's Lace flower is a really gorgeous flower that grows in this meadow. And when it starts to become a seed head, it actually closes in on itself. It becomes kind of like a ball. So what I did is I took that shape, flipped it upside down so that the stem is sticking up in the air, and you can actually go inside of the seed head there. And there's porthole windows, and it's got kind of lots of movement and whimsy. But the reason that I chose the Queen Anne's Lace flower is twofold. One is that they actually grow here in the meadow, and when I was walking the grounds, I saw them and was inspired by them. And the other is that one of the founders of the Brandywine River Museum of Art is named Frolic. And when I first came to the Brandywine, he was the person that I spoke to, and he was an older man, really amazing human being. He founded it in the 70s with just kind of a dream, turning this old mill into this world-class museum, and that's what it is today, to house all the amazing artists that lived in the Brandywine, including the Wyatts. So he's a painter, and his most famous painting, and one that hung on my wall when I was a kid, was a print of this painting called August. It's a beautiful hillside covered in Queen Anne's lace. Going up to the top of this hill, there's a like stick rising up into the sun. It's gorgeous. So when I came to the Brandywine, it was him that I started meeting with, and we drove all around, and we were getting excited about building some sort of sculpture on the land. And then he ended up dying later that year. And so part of the reason that I chose the Queen Anne's Lace is really an homage to him and the paintings that he did and just the work that he's done in the Brandywine Conservancy. I think my work is best understood and is best when I can relate to the history, the human history and the natural history of a place, because then it becomes not as much about me and what I think, but just my reactions and my thoughts about, the world that I'm inhabiting. So I really love that piece of the sculpture where it was about the landscape, it was about the humans that have inhabited and been protecting it, and it was about me as well. And I love part of that also is like the, all of the wood comes from that land that creates the sculpture, and that's important to me as well.
All right, Ian, you are a Virginia-based artist. You were commissioned by the Brandywine River Museum of Art as part of its ongoing sculptural program, inviting artists to explore their responses to the local landscape. And I'll come back to that in a minute. What is your background?
Yeah, I grew up in Denver, right outside of Denver, and spent most of my childhood in this irrigation ditch behind our house called the Highline Canal. It is this beautiful kind of biking trail, but it's an old irrigation ditch back in the days when Colorado had to bring all of its water from the rivers to the farmlands. And so it was just kind of this magical little hideaway. You could kind of, it was like down in a ditch and everything was overgrown in there, and I could really escape in there. So I spent a lot of my childhood in that, and that I kind of credit with my connection to the wild. And so I grew up in Denver, and then I went to high school in Delaware near my grandmother's house in Wilmington. And then I ended up going to the Colorado College, and I studied art there. So I did my bachelor's in art at Colorado College. And then after that, I went to Oregon. After college, I ended up going up to Oregon, and I attended Upper Vitro Natural Building School. So I learned some of the techniques that I use now in terms of plastering with clay and building with non-straight materials there. It's a really amazing place that teaches permaculture and natural building. And then I found my way to Virginia, which is where I live now, and I'm a high school teacher. I teach art and lots of other things at a really amazing place called Springhouse Community School here in Floyd, Virginia. We're a little micro school. We've got 33 students this year from 7th through 12th grade, and we do some amazing things and I get to teach them about being in nature and experience building things outside with them. And it's really a great place for me to reconnect with the wild, reconnect with humanity, and help others do the same.
So it sounds like you grew up, in the Midwest, and then you came to Delaware on the East Coast, and then you went back to college. So what is your favorite outdoor place, if you will? What is your favorite season? Maybe I should ask it that way.
Nice. Well, I'm going to take your question in a little bit of a different way just because I think it's interesting. You know what I love? So I grew up in Denver, and it's epic. Anyone who's ever been to Colorado, it's like you come to the Front Range, the mountains are 14,000 feet tall. It's gorgeous. There's vistas, there's elk and bears. And it's just there's no question whether it's beautiful. It hits you right in the face with its beauty. And I think since I've been living in Virginia, I've really, it's the beauty here and the connection is really much more subtle. It's quieter. The mountains are much older, right? So the Appalachian Mountains are some of the oldest mountain ranges in the world. So they've got, it's more rounded. You almost never get a vista. So it's taken a lot more slowness and time spent to really feel connected to this landscape and to really recognize this beauty. And I think because of that, it's richer for me. So I really love these Appalachian Mountains that I live in. And I think my favorite season is fall, which luckily it is now. And the leaves are just starting to change here, and it's really gorgeous. But I love the fall just because, I don't know, there's something about slowing down and, I don't know, the coolness and, maybe it's the colors. I don't know, but I love it.
We are talking to Virginia-based artist Ian Stabler about this new exhibit at the Brandywine Conservancy and Museum of Arts. It's called Queen Anne's Lace Pod. How long did it take you to put together?
It took about a month and a half. If you go to it, you'll see that there's no shade there. And so it was in kind of that heat wave of end of June, early July that I was building it. And it was intense. Once I actually built the sculpture, I could hide inside, and it was kind of shaded inside. But for that first part, it was pretty intense. So it took about a month and a half.
Ian, what's the takeaway from this exhibit? What do you want people to talk about when they're leaving, after they've seen it? What do you want them to talk about?
So really what I want is I want people to go and sit and look out the windows and just experience that meadow. Because, again, it's a subtle place. It's a place that takes some time. And sitting there and spending that month and a half, I really realized how intimate that place is, the birds moving through and the bees and all of this interaction. It's very kind of mundane. And in that mundaneness, it's really gorgeous. I also I think there's something cool happens when you take something that's small, like a Queen Anne's Lace Pod, and you make it big, and all of a sudden we start to pay better attention to this amazing biological architecture that's all around us. The way that these plants have evolved to be beautiful, functional, and relate to their environments in very specific and efficient ways, I think is a real marvel that takes time. It takes energy to really look at it. So my hope is that folks go out and they come back loving the meadow, loving the places and the plants around them, or even just taking a second look at them.
This almost sounds like something a Queen Anne's Lace Pod should be a permanent installation.
At this point, it's a temporary installation. It's going to be up, I think, until May. And we'll see what happens to it then. But I'm always down to build another one, I guess, if it gets taken down.
Thanks to artist Ian Stabler and R. Kelly Steele for joining us on this week's Arts Playlist. And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Green. The stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, The Green can also be found via podcast at our website, on Apple Podcasts, and on the NPR One app. We'd also like to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter, at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Support for The Green comes in part from the Delaware Alliance for Nonprofit Advancement. Dana is an advocate for nonprofits, offering strategies to strengthen leadership skills, improve board effectiveness, and enhance nonprofit sustainability. Learn more at DelawareNonprofit.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt and Kelly Steele, and our show producer, Rebecca Baer. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Bernstein. Thanks for joining us this week. And we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delawareans get tuned into a first state of mind.